And welcome once again to EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Heck, your host. Our guest author, well known to EWTN viewers, Matthew Bunsen. His book, Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope, proudly published by EWTN Publishing, available naturally through our EWTN religious catalog, EWTNRC.com for all things Catholic. Always great to see you, Matthew, in person there after spending all that time in the past covering the Pope.
Yeah, and I'm grateful for the fact that you're proudly publishing this book.
We are proudly publishing it. And it brings me back how many years to the first time we met, like in 1997.
That's right.
At OSV.
Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Right. First time. One of the books you had done at the time.
I think it was the Encyclopedia of Catholic History.
I think it was. And, you know, I didn't realize that you were actually the Catholic Encyclopedia yourself. I thought it was just a book at the time.
But I strive to be a Catholic Encyclopedia.
Watching you between the series you've done on the Doctors of the Church for us, and obviously off the cuff in many of the events that you've worked on, and certainly recently when the election of the Holy Father and all of that, your ability to pull up information and facts is simply astounding. Were you always interested in history in general?
Always, yeah. I had the joy, and I mean joy seriously, literally growing up in a chancery office, in the chancery office of the Diocese of Honolulu. And there was
so not only a chancery office, but Honolulu.
Honolulu, yes, the Diocese of Honolulu.
Were you hanging out with Father Spitzer at the time or something?
You know, it's so funny because I know we were there about the same time, but never crossed paths, unfortunately. No. Different high schools and all. I think he was a little ahead of me.
Okay.
But, I mean,
he's still a little ahead of all of us.
But, he will always be. Not just a little. He's way ahead of us. But, so there were these books in the little library in the chancery, and that's where I first developed this great passionate love for church history, the church, the saints, and they had, you said the word, this whole set of the old Catholic Encyclopedia.
Right.
So as a kid, I just started reading it.
Didn't understand
much of it, but as time went on, it just became even more and more interesting.
Right. Now, this particular book, you know, obviously you were covering it, so you have a sense, you had a feel there.
Yeah.
We can get into the book. What would you what was the feel in Rome as it transitioned from the passing of Francis to the election of Leo XIV?
It was really interesting. This is my third conclave, but the first time that I've had the privilege of being like on air for the whole duration of it, and then to covering it from start to finish. And the thing that really stays with me about this is, and I say this seriously, how prayerful the whole experience was. When I was talking with the cardinals who were there and everyone who was participating, there was this real sense of discernment of prayer. The way that Pope Francis died on Easter Monday. We had just seen him the day before Easter Sunday. There was this intense moment about it where he kind of said farewell.
Really?
When he did the circuit in the Pope Mobile and he was up on the loggia.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
The first time that we saw him as Pope was on the loggia. The last time we saw him as Pope was on the loggia. And then we had the funeral, the Novendialis, and each of those masses that we were able to cover, we paid close attention to the homilies because we were getting to know the cardinals.
Right.
And all of them were talking intensely about how much they were praying together. And I think that's where the key to understanding the conclave was, because they extended it by a couple of days to give themselves a chance to know each other a little better. You know, Francis never brought them to Rome.
Well, that was going to say, that was one of the things where in the past, one of the reasons they would bring the cardinals was to get to know each other, right?
That's right. It didn't happen. It happened once in 2014.
And why do you think he managed that way, or he went about that way? Any thoughts?
I think he was somebody who was very preoccupied, and from his standpoint, in a necessary way, on advancing certain things for the church and promoting them. And I think he'd had a rough experience with some of the cardinals in 2014 in the Synod on the Family. And it's one of the reasons why he didn't bring them back together
Another
till 2022. And when he did bring them all together, it was basically 3 days of sort of lectures and discussions with them, but not amongst themselves.
Right.
On
not particularly synodal, really, in the sense of conversation.
Well, I mean, as consistories go,
it
was not traditional. So they were receiving lectures, for example, on the reform of the Curia, especially Praedicate Evangelium, the document that sort of reformed the whole curial structure. And then there were discussions about synodality. And at that point, some of the cardinals complained, well, we're being given no time to get to know each other. When you compound that with the fact that the incredible I mean, truly remarkable diversity that he introduced into the college of cardinals from all over the world. It made it necessary when they did gather for the conclave for them to take that extra time. It's why they gave themselves two extra days, basically, for more meetings. And the hallmark of that was frankness amongst themselves. We know some of the cardinals expressed some displeasure with some of the decisions under Pope Francis, and others saw that as sort of a betrayal of the previous pontificate. Others saw that as a necessary discussion as they were trying to discern who is going to follow Francis. And I, at the end of the day, I think all of them said they benefited from the frankness of the conversations, but then also that little bit of extra time to get to know each other.
Well, in some ways, you could say that's what Pope Francis always said he wanted.
Right.
He wanted to be able to discuss things that people had kind of said, well, we can't talk about that anymore.
Right.
In a frank way. And
So the whole experience then of that, the ramp up to the conclave, yes, there were a lot of discussions about the papabili, because there always are. That's part of this whole process. But I think there was a very sober approach on the part of these cardinals. You could see it. As to the task that was ahead of them, because it was a difficult task replacing, having somebody succeed a very unique pontiff like Francis is not an easy thing to do.
Right, and it seemed to be that the thought was, and in reading the book, is that not that the present Holy Father was somebody who people weren't considering, but it was always kind of like, well, he might be really good, but he's an American.
That's right. Right. That was the primary thing. We had lists of what we knew the general congregations, the cardinals, were talking about amongst themselves. They needed somebody who was an expert in law. They needed somebody who had a true missionary spirit, somebody who actually knew the mission, somebody who had administrative
skills. Well, let me ask you, let's go back and tick off those things. So they wanted somebody who was expert in law. He's a canon lawyer.
That's
right.
Why
did they want somebody like that?
Well, in part because Pope Francis had introduced many important innovations in some areas of church law. He made changes to the catechism, for example, but he changed some of the structures in how the curia functioned, so the pontifical universities functioned. He thought that they were very important. And at the same time, when you introduce these innovations through a decree called a motu proprio, which means a by my own hand by a pope, the best way I describe
it's kind of an executive order.
Exactly, that's it. When a president issues an executive order. Now, it means that the next pope, as supreme lawgiver, he can rescind them, he can reinforce them, whatever he wants to do. Traditionis custodes, which brought this sort of, some have used the term crackdown, however you want to do it, restrictions on the traditional Latin Mass, that in many ways is seen also as an indicator of, there are a lot of questions that have emerged out of that, canonically, liturgically. And so one of the things that they wanted was a lawgiver, somebody who was an expert in law, who could really address these from the standpoint of the Supreme Pontiff, but who bring to bear that whole tradition of canon law. Is this feasible? How is it turning out? Look at it. And in terms of the missionary field, they wanted somebody who understood the positioning of the church, where the church is everywhere now, but what does it mean to be a missionary church in today's world? We still have these great missions in Africa, in Asia, and elsewhere, but we also have to be considering the West, the United States, North America, Western Europe, to be a new type of mission territory. Is this person that we're seeking, do they bring that to bear too? Then there's the question of where do they stand on things like synodality? Is this somebody that, are we looking for, some cardinals asked, a carbon copy? Are we looking for Francis II, somebody who would rigidly adhere to Francis's vision of synodality, or are we looking for somebody who might assess synodality and say, this is important, but here's a little bit of a direction that I want to take it in. So all of those things, when applied to Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost, he ticked all of the boxes that they were talking about. But he seemed to have this insurmountable obstacle of being an American.
Right, but I guess his, what he had was the Latin American aspect because of the missionary aspect of being in Peru for so many years.
Right. And also
and
as
being
head
a religious.
And as head of the Augustinian order for 12 years, he literally traveled the globe.
Right.
So he knew the church universally, but he was also known by so many leaders of the church universally.
Right, absolutely. So on May 8th, tens of thousands of people got to St. Peter's, talk about waiting. On the fourth vote, the first of the afternoon, should have happened by a certain time, in which case you had a sense something was going on. Smoke showed up at 6:08 p.m. Rome time, 267 Pope. The ballots were burned according to the rules of the conclave, and end up with the white smoke as long as they can get the right smoke coming out.
Yes, exactly.
In the past, right. There were some times
not without some errors in the past. Yeah.
Right, we're kind of like, well, is that white? Is it black? We
sort
can't
of smudgy.
Tell. Right.
Yeah.
So when it was delayed like that, what's the feeling at that time? Is it a feeling like, okay, they've kind of run through the early favorites, and now they're moving on to kind of like, I don't want to say a compromise candidate, but in some ways.
So they'd had what we knew would be the third vote, culminating in the morning, and then they burned the ballot, so we had black smoke that morning. Then we all came back. Now, the rules always were that if you had an inconclusive vote for the first vote in the afternoon, you keep the ballots, and then you move immediately to the next ballot, so that would have been the fifth ballot.
Okay.
Our understanding is there was a story, a rumor, that somehow they'd had a mistake happen. So the rules are that is immediately invalid and you move to the next ballot.
Mm-hmm.
I've also heard that there was just a small delay in getting everybody back, basically from Pronzo, for the fourth vote.
Mm-hmm.
So we know now that the election was achieved on the fourth ballot. So by way of context, that was the ballot that also elected Joseph Ratzinger in 2005 as Benedict XVI.
Mm-hmm.
Francis was elected on the fifth ballot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now the first thing he says is, peace be with you all. He went on, dear brothers and sisters, these are the first words spoken by the risen Christ. What was your take when you heard him say that?
That, in hindsight now, and I think at the moment too, there was something deeply significant about that, because he was proclaiming, yes, he was proclaiming the words of Jesus Christ, but he was also very specific about what kind of peace he was talking about.
Right, not necessarily peace the way people in the secular world understand it, so explain.
Right, so it's not a type of secular peace, it's not a false peace. As one cardinal said to me, peace treaties can achieve peace, but treaties are broken, treaties are forgotten, treaties are rewritten.
Mm.
You can have ceasefires, you can have this false peace, and the peace that the secular world or the culture can give you does not last. The peace of the risen Christ is true. It is authentic peace. It is the peace that we're all searching for.
So was that an internal peace?
It is a peace.
And then lived out?
Authentic peace within yourself, because you've had that encounter with Jesus Christ. But then that's also a peace, and this is very Augustinian, that when you have searched for God and you have found him, the love of God that then is a wellspring in your heart, in your soul, you have to then carry that out into the love of neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this impulse for the love of neighbor to take that out into the world. But it's that peace, it's that famous phrase from Augustine, you know, in creatum cor nostrum est, donec requiescat in te. Our hearts are restless until they rest in you. That rest is the peace of Christ. And he was proclaiming from his very first words his desire for peace. Now that also brings with it then the unity that only the peace of
the
Christ.
The bridge builder aspect.
The bridge builder.
Okay. And why do you think people inside the church, the cardinals, thought that's what they needed?
Yeah. Well, there were a couple things at play. Once they began to get to know him better, many of the cardinals knew him only by reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been prefect for the dicastery bishops for 2 years.
So there would have been some knowledge just based on that.
Some knowledge.
Right.
A number of them knew him from his days as head of the Augustinians, because he traveled the world. Some of the Latin Americans knew him from his time when he was a bishop in Peru. So they had a sense of him. And then his reputation as prefect was of somebody who never lost his temper, but he wasn't emotionally detached. Somebody who was very good, and not just building a consensus, because it's the same type of, how are we coalescing? Rather, somebody who actually made decisions based on prudence, on temperance, and justice.
Mm-hmm.
And he was known for being a great listener, one of the Latin American cardinals.
Right, you talk about that in the book.
That he has one mouth and 2 ears. So he was a great listener, but he was also very decisive. Once he assessed a situation, he would make a decision and stay with it, because he had confidence that it was the right one. So that was part of the reputation. A lot of them, Cardinal Timothy Dolan, wrote that he didn't really know him very well, but he was struck by the fact that immediately after arriving in Rome, other cardinals assumed that he would know him.
Because he's an American.
He's an American. So they were asking him, what do you know about Cardinal Prevost? And he said, well, actually not much. So he made it a point to get to know him too. And the more that they spent time with him, It was a funny thing because when he was in the conclave and the ramp up to it, in the general congregations, a lot of the cardinals couldn't remember something specific that he said. You know, when we go back to like 2013, it was that 4.5 minute speech that Cardinal Bergoglio gave that won over all of the cardinals that this could be the guy. There wasn't anything specific mm-hmm. that Cardinal Prevost said, but there was something about him in how he dealt with people, the conversations he had that mm-hmm. stayed with them. It was the exact same type of set of comments that people were giving of their lived experience with him in the two different synods in 2023 and 2024, and the synod on synodality.
So that was who he was, not who he portrayed himself to
right.
be.
Right, and he didn't win people over with his rhetoric or his flashy comments, not that that was what Bergoglio yeah. did, but there was something about him. There was a serenity about him. And there was a desire for a pope who would be a calming figure at a right. time when the world is fractured and in many ways in whole parts of the church too.
As well. Right. And I think even the Holy Father, Pope Francis, would admit that he was still Jorge in a lot of ways, he would say.
Yes.
And so that aspect of his personality, which is that things he believed strongly in, he wanted to have happen
right.
and was not always good at brooking opposition
right.
and would tend to push forward mm-hmm. even if he felt like others weren't supportive.
Right, and there were cardinals who, in those general congregations, I think, for example, of Cardinal Beniamino Stella, who actually received his red hat from Francis, who had complained about some of the leadership style. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the things they're looking for was somebody who would be able to be that bridge builder, who would bring a certain calm. And I think it was Corriere della Sera, one of the Italian newspapers, one of its headlines was, mm-hmm. when Papa Calma, he is a calm pope. He is serene in how he approaches things. Again, he's not emotionally detached, but he has a certain detachment mm-hmm. that you can see, and it lives out in how he greets people
right.
and decisions he makes.
Well, hopefully that detachment is one from worrying about what people think or what the repercussions might be, as long as I'm doing Christ's work.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and it was said about him when he was the two-term head of the Augustinians, so he was there for 12 years. Mm-hmm.
Was that unusual to be?
No, but I think it was a testament that the renewal of his term demonstrates that he was considered to be very successful mm-hmm. And very popular. Mm-hmm. But it was said at the end of his term that those who had dealt with him, that in the decisions he had made, no one felt within the Augustinian order that he had done them an injustice. Mm-hmm. And given the variety of decisions that you have to make,
right.
Personnel decisions in terms of property and everything else,
yeah.
that can be right. A difficult task.
I may disagree, but I felt you were fair.
Right.
You made a decision.
And that
based
I was heard.
What you thought. Right.
Yeah.
That I was heard. And that was apparently something that a lot of people felt over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the longer the pontificate of Francis went on, the more people kind of felt like there was less listening than maybe there had been early on.
Yeah, there were, of course, frustrations. Mm-hmm. You know, in any pontificate as it goes on,
right.
you're going to have issues that crop up, and the personality of the Pope also matters very much.
It's interesting, too, because my guess would be his personality, and because they view him as an American in the sense of South American,
right.
North American, but the idea of that personality is not the one that most people around the world see as an American personality.
That's right. And
right.
I think that was one of the reasons that he was elected. So as I was saying, he checked all of these great boxes. But then as they got to know him, they realized he doesn't seem very American in that sort of traditional loud and all the other
not
senses.
Not that we like that at all.
No, not at all.
So.
But I think it was Cardinal Daniel Dennard, the Archbishop Emeritus of Galveston, Houston, who made the point that he really comes across more as a universal figure,
mm-hmm.
and which is a fair comment to make because he'd been gone for so many years
mm-hmm.
From the United States, still American. He's not un-American. He doesn't hate America. And quite the opposite. I mean, he's still a White Sox fan. We know that as Cardinal Prevost, he came back to Chicago, the Chicago area where he grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because he loves that part of the world and he has family here. His
right.
brothers are here. But he was somebody who was also very much a person of the church. And he had left home.
Well, as you talk about in the book, his family was very fairly religious. His parents were educators.
Exactly.
Right? And the home he lived in was not an ostentatious home at all.
No, not at all. But he then spent all those years in Peru. And he was a naturalized Peruvian citizen.
Mm-hmm.
As a bishop, that was certainly essential. but he loves Peru. Mm-hmm. And that's a love.
What do you think in reading his writings and this story, why did he want to be a missionary? And as a missionary in the world we live in today, you kind of get the idea what Isaac Jogues thought he was doing and some of the other missionaries yes. thought they were doing in a sense of, I would say literally, well, we need to convert you and we need to reach out to you because you need to know the gospel because mm-hmm. otherwise you may not make it, so to speak.
Right.
We don't quite have that perspective as much anymore, at least, let's say maybe it's officially that way, but let's say unofficially, it's right. a little more of a, well, we're not really saying that. So what was his main motivation, do you think?
It's very clear that as a child, he was drawn to the priesthood.
Yeah, he was doing mass on an iron
exactly.
board, right?
Yeah. But
Nick all wafers.
Which is fantastic. Right. I mean, and his family was there to support him in that. But right. somewhere along the line, not only that, but he was drawn to the religious life. Mm-hmm. And he was drawn specifically to the Augustinian life. And I think having those encounters with Augustine, having encounters with Augustinian priests and members right. of the Augustinian order drew him into that. And part of it, of course, part of that mission of the Augustinians is, all right, we have the pursuit of the truth. We have the love of God, love of neighbor. Now let's take that into the world. Mm-hmm. So missionary work is one of the keys to the Augustinian tradition, certainly the Augustinian order. Mm-hmm. So going into this, he understood that the likelihood was going to be that he would end up serving in the missions. Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable to me that 3 years after he was ordained, so he's still a very young guy, mm-hmm. they send him to Peru in what is a very challenging missionary environment.
Right, as you say in the book, you talk about poverty, we think of poverty in the United States, we haven't seen poverty.
Right. Yeah, and
certainly when they talk about the people in the hills and stuff.
Right, and it could only be reached by donkeys and mm-hmm. horses, and if you could drive, you took your life into your hands
right.
driving those roads. But it was also, and this is a hallmark of a missionary in any setting, it was the adaptability to every culture and language, the nuance of a place where you arrive. I think of Francis Xavier, that he could land anywhere in Asia. And within a short time, he was speaking the language, he understood the customs, he loved the people. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he saw that as a bridge to them, mm-hmm. but not to dominate them or to westernize them, but to help them have that encounter
from
with
the
Jesus.
Gift, basically.
Right, exactly.
The gift of Christ, the gift love of Christ. And salvation. Why do you think with all of that, you see here he's working with poor people, he's in a mission, you know, people would think it's kind of backward, but yet he's worried about AI.
Yes.
Why?
I think for two different reasons, but they're related at the end of the day. The first is that he, as somebody who has lived in America, who has also now spent many, many years in Peru, has traveled the world, he has seen the practical impact of things like social media, the impact of AI on the lives of ordinary people around the world.
Right.
In exactly the same way that one of the reasons he took the name, Leo XIV, in exactly the same way that Leo XIII saw the great the dangers and problems being created by the Industrial Revolution mm-hmm. and bringing to bear the wisdom of the church on that field, which led to Rerum Novarum in 1891 and the whole magnificent tradition of modern Catholic social teaching. He sees those same threats, but he saw them, the impact it had on American culture, but then also wherever you go in the world,
right.
you're seeing it. The other aspect.
In many cases, it's an American culture, too.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. So it's what Pope Francis thought beautifully summed it up about cultural imperialism. Ideological
right.
colonization.
Right.
So we're seeing it. So he's seeing the impact of that. The other aspect, I think, for him was that in this fascination with social media and other things, as an Augustinian in that tradition, the recognition of the need for proper formation, of intellectual formation. So he's talked about, he said this as the head of the Augustinians, and he still talked about it as cardinal, why we need to form, especially young people, in how to use the tools of social media so mm-hmm. that you're not overwhelmed, so it doesn't destroy your life,
right.
so you can find the truth there. It's evangelizing the digital continent, as Benedict XVI said. So I think
right.
it's the practical side, but he's not afraid of it. Which I think is
right,
an important
certainly,
point.
I think what EW10 is trying to do with Next and,
exactly.
and Plus. It's interesting because the church needs a renewal of her social teaching. And go on to say, a renewal of Catholic social teaching for the contemporary world will not flatter any one political figure or movement, nor will we be describable in any adjective like conservative or progressive, which mm-hmm. is, I think, when we try and put those political perspectives on top of the church, we run into problems.
That's right. And one thing that I find notable about Leo in his early days is how, yes, he's going back to Rerum Novarum, the work of Leo XIII, but he's also distilling it down to the essence, the heart of Catholic social teaching, in exactly the same way that Leo did. Yes, Leo talked about capitalism and labor and everything else, but for Leo XIV, exactly as the great Catholic social teaching should, it is the defense and fostering and nurturing of the human person to promote flourishing, to promote the common good. So he's seeing the human person today at risk, and how then the expressions of that in the family, his defense, for example, of family, of union of a man and a woman.
Right.
He doesn't have to say that. He could just leave it at family. But he's very specific.
Well, that's been an issue when people have had some concerns because some of the clarity or lack of clarity in the last 12 years has been there.
His first weeks are extremely clear in what he's saying and how he's teaching. But it's that the defense of the human person and the pursuit of the common good in this modern setting. And to do that, we need the application of Catholic social teaching.
Right, in the virtual world. Just before we go, in essentials unity and non-essentials diversity, in all things charity, as you say, whether Augustine ever said that or not is one thing, maybe he had the sense of it. The problem sometimes with these things is, which ones are the essentials?
For him, I think it's the wisdom of the fathers of the church. He keeps going back to them, and boy, what a treasury to base yourself on.
Okay, we'll look forward to it. Look forward to more work from you.
Thank
you. Mr. Bunsen, of course.
Privilege.
Matthew Bunsen, author of Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. Can you believe it? Proudly published, as I said, by EWTN Publishing and naturally available through our catalogs. Check it out. Find out who our new Pope is. And check us out next time right here on EWTN's Bookmark. I'm Doug Keck. Thanks.